Hey, weirdos, Elena here. If you're looking to kick back and relax with Morbid, Wondery Plus is the way to go. It's like having a cozy seat in our haunted mansion. No ads, just you and early access to new episodes. You can join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or in Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
You're listening to a Morbid Network podcast.
Hey everyone, let's talk about protein for a second. There's this rumor that getting plant-based protein is tough, but listen, there are some amazing options out there. Even if you're not vegan, adding more plant-based protein to your diet is a fantastic way to nourish your body and support the planet. My go-to for tasty protein and superfood-packed shake is Cachava. Every serving of Cachava offers 25 grams of 100% plant-based protein, but that's not all. This all-in-one shake has fiber, quality fats, vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and so much more. I love that I can tick so many boxes with just one delicious shake. If you know me, you know that vanilla and chai are my favorite flavors and I like to combine them. But they also have chocolate, they've got matcha, and they've got coconut acai. I'm a big fan of the coconut acai as well. After drinking Cachava first thing in the morning, because that's when I always drink it, I feel satiated for hours. I feel focused, calm, and ready to take on my day. Something that I really love to do if I even want like a little bit more protein is just add a scoop of peanut butter to the vanilla and chai concoction that I make. And that, is just scrum diddly umptious, honey. Cachava is offering our listeners 10% off on their subscription for a limited time. Just go to cachava.com/morbid, spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com/morbid. What's it like to get the new iPhone 16 Pro with AT&T next up anytime? It's like when you first light up the grill and think of all the mouthwatering possibilities. Learn how to get the new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence on AT&T and the latest iPhone every year with AT&T next up anytime. AT&T, connecting changes everything. Apple Intelligence coming fall 2024 with Siri and device language set to U.S. English. Some features and languages will be coming over the next year. $0 offer may not be available on future iPhones. Next up anytime features may be discontinued at any time, subject to change. Additional fees, terms, and restrictions apply. See AT&T.com/iPhone for details.
Hey, weirdos, I'm Ash.
And I'm Elena.
And this is Morbid.
I'm sick.
She's like very loopy. Did you take DayQuil today?
No.
You didn't take anything?
I didn't.
You're so loopy today.
I'm raw dogging the day.
Whoa. Settle down, brother. It's been very funny up in the pod lab today. It's been we're good time gals today.
We are.
Mikey included.
Mikey is part of the good time gals.
What's up with you? How's your, what day is this coming out?
You're like, what's going on?
I think this comes out like after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So, like, how was your Thanksgiving?
Well, it was great. You were there.
Yeah, I was. I was just looking for things to chat about.
I'm just being a dick.
You douche! We just started screaming at each
like,
other.
Fuck you! We just turned off the mic. Just an hour of silence. No, Thanksgiving was great.
Yeah, I liked it. You're a great cook.
Thanks.
You bet.
I hope you guys ate all kinds of delicious things.
I forgot to take leftovers, and then you went away for a weekend.
I know.
And I didn't get to go out. We were all supposed to go away and do like this fun little family thing, and I couldn't because my cat was sick. My little Frankie was sick, and it turns out it was very scary, you guys. If your cat has ever passed a stone and you think that somebody's been murdered in your house, same. The amount of blood that I was finding just in various spots throughout my house, I was like, oh my God.
That sounds terrifying.
It was so scary. And we knew that Franklin like wasn't feeling well because he gets super cuddly when he doesn't feel well. So we took him to the vet and it turns out he passed one stone. But unfortunately, my man still has one to pass. So
he's out here.
Yeah. But they sent his like cultures to Italy or something.
That's fancy as hell.
I know. And the cultures came back and they didn't have bacteria. So that's my cat's health for you. He's okay. And I love him so much. Thank you.
We love Frankie.
Frankie forever. You and Franklin have a spiritual connection.
We really do.
No, you do. And Franklin doesn't like very many people.
No, that's what makes me feel so good.
Yeah, he loves you.
Because he'll come up and snuggle me on my lap.
Yeah. And he's not snuggly with just anybody. No like way. Even Drew, he's like sometimes snuggly with, but most of the time it just me.
But me? Always snuggly.
Always. I know.
Always. Me and Frankie for life. It's getting to the end of the day.
It's getting to the end of the day and we're goofy.
We're goofy loofy.
We're not going to be goofy for long, though, because I do actually have a very sad case today.
That's why we're getting it out now.
Yes, exactly. We had to get it out of our systems. You feel ungoofied?
I believe I do. I just have a cold. I don't have COVID or anything.
Oh, yeah. You guys are wondering. Back to you.
Yeah, I just like, I don't have a...
Yeah.
I'm not like out here spreading COVID to Ash.
Can you imagine if she did that to me?
That'd be shitty as
again.
Hell. It would be shitty as hell.
Your book tour gave us COVID and then.
I know.
And then.
But no, it's just a cold. It's one of those. You sound kids like are back to school. I get all the delicious germs that come floating in here. I just eat them up.
The most wonderful time of the year. But you did determine that you actually did eat the germs up.
I think that's I did. Oh, yeah. Because I determined my kids, they're not sick, knock on wood.
They're just carrier
pigeons here, bringing it into me. When we have, like, lots of after-school activities that we have to, like, go in different directions to, I will, like, have to be, like, eating, you know, kind of quick and on the go. So if they don't finish something, I'll just like quickly eat it up.
Of course.
Whatever they
I'll
didn't
quickly
finish.
Scoop that up.
Just to like get some fuel for the next thing.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty, that's probably what happened.
Yeah. They're gross, nasty saliva germs around them. That's why
I just ate it up.
They're always trying to drink out of my water bottle and I'm like, get the fuck away from TT's stuff.
It's true.
Do not touch TT's water
bottle.
She doesn't
say that.
I don't say that. Can you imagine?
Oh my God.
No, I would never. But I did say the other day at dance class, I was like, no, this is a grown-up drink because I'm drinking like, it's like Armour colostrum. So I'm like, you guys probably shouldn't drink that.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, fuck. Everybody at all the other moms probably thought that I said
you had like,
wine
in your tumbler.
I'm just sipping on the scissor at dance class.
Like, this is a grown-up drink. They're like, what?
They're like, wow, TT.
Yeah.
You're crazy.
Yeah. So any parents or people taking care of little kids out there, My thoughts are with you at this difficult time.
Your heart will go
on. Back to school during the winter and fall.
It's rough.
But we're good.
You're good, but it's only the start of the season.
I know. Hopefully I'm building some immunity. I'm on vitamins.
Yeah, take some emergency.
Yeah. We love an emergency moment here.
I do too, yeah.
Some liquid IV.
Liquid IV, of course, a sponsor.
Hell yeah.
The colostrum I'm taking is great. 10 out of 10 recommend. Not a doctor, but.
And that's health.
And wellness.
With me being sick.
And me not being sick. So let's get into it today, brothers. I have an older case, but it's, you know how we always are like, we do the older cases because the way that they solve it is always like so interesting.
Yes.
This case in particular, the way they solve this case is actually wild. Like it took some serious detective work and it took somebody going back to the scene to find something that really even like drove it home further.
Oh,
which
love
I love
that.
The dedication.
Yeah.
So we're going to be talking today about the murder of Nancy Evans Titterton. And I just want to say, she sounds like she was like so cool.
Oh.
And just like sweet.
Poor Nancy.
And I feel bad because she just had her career like really start to take off. Like she was really like climbing the ladder in the right direction. And this crime, all crime is obviously pretty senseless. But this one specifically was so senseless.
Ugh.
So let's get into it. So Nancy Violet Evans was born in 1903 in Dayton, Ohio, to Frank and Stephanie Evans. From a very young age, she took a strong interest in reading and writing. And after she graduated from high school in 1920, she decided she was going to get her degree in English at Antioch College. She crushed it there. She won multiple awards for her writing. And once she graduated from college in 1924, she went back home to Dayton. She worked briefly in a factory, but then moved on to run a small bookshop. But then decided she wanted a little bit more for herself. So she moved to the Big Apple, New York City, and she decided there she was going to pursue a literary career.
Wow.
Yeah, just rolling with it. Rolling with the literary punches. So when she got to New York, Nancy rented a small apartment in Greenwich Village, and she found a job as a bookseller at Lord & Taylor, which is funny to think about Lord & Taylor selling books.
I know.
But in her spare time, she focused on making connections in the literary world. She wrote book reviews for a bunch of New York newspapers, just writing anywhere she could.
That's awesome.
Really trying to get her name out there. And the work of writing book reviews back then wasn't really glamorous, but she did it so that it would keep her connected to her passion. And after a few years, she was offered a job at Doubleday Books, which was one of the most prominent names in publishing at the time. And there, she was instrumental in building the company's nascent but increasingly popular Crime Club series.
Oh.
Which was a true crime series.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so she had an interest in that. One friend later told reporters, the principal thing about Nancy was that she was not flashy in any way. She'd rather discuss a new book, I think, than anything.
Aww.
She wasn't interested in politics or parties or clothes, as most women are. So in 1927, Nancy met Lewis Titterton, a British man who also loved literature and writing just as much as she did. Lewis Titterton had been a star academic at Harvard and at Cambridge University.
Damn. So,
very educated man. He studied Middle Eastern languages there before he took a job as the assistant editor at Atlantic Monthly, which was a really, really impressive achievement for somebody who was still in his 20s. The job at Atlantic opened doors for him in the literary world, and within a few years, he moved on to a position as associate editor at the Macmillan Company, one of the biggest names in publishing as well. And like Nancy, he also spent his spare time writing book reviews.
Huh.
Which you just think of the two of them. And they're a good couple, don't worry. You just think of the two of them.
Please tell me I can like them.
Yeah, just like sitting at home writing book reviews together. Like, that's just such a cozy life I thought they were living.
That.
They dated for 2 years, and then they got married in October of 1929 in a small ceremony at the little church around the corner, famous landmark in New York City. And not long after their wedding, they moved to the Beekman Place apartments on the east side of Manhattan.
Mm.
Now, in the few years that followed, Beekman Place would actually gain quite some notoriety for a series of unconnected murders, beginning in 1935 when Vera Stretz murdered her boyfriend. And then that was followed by Nancy Titterton's murder 6 months later in 1936. And finally, the murder of Veronica Gideon in 1937, which we actually just recently covered.
Yeah.
So, interesting.
Jeez.
Yeah. You just wonder like what the energy was in that place.
Yeah.
You know? In a tragically ironic twist, actually just after moving into Beekman, Nancy wrote to a friend about how much she loved her new place. She said, I'm so glad to get out of Hell's Kitchen. Even though we had bars on the window, I never felt safe there. Nothing could happen to anyone on Beekman Place.
Oh, no.
Which, very much could.
Oh, no.
But Nancy and Lewis had a lot of good years before tragedy visited Beekman Place. By then, Lewis had accepted a new job as the chief of the script division at NBC Radio. And for somebody who spent his entire professional life focused on literature and language, this new position was difficult. But as Harold Schechter wrote, Lewis was, quote, intent on elevating the cultural quality of radio programming.
Hmm.
It's like really heady people, you know?
Yeah.
At the same time, Nancy had made a major transition of her own. She actually left her job at Doubleday to focus on her own writing full-time. At first, her success was pretty slow to come. She published a few stories in various literary magazines, but she was really struggling to find her home as an author. Then, in 1935, Story Magazine, which was a prestigious journal known for launching some of the biggest authors of the day, they offered to publish her short story called I Shall Decline My Head. It was a story about a, quote, old man adrift in dreams of the past.
Hmm.
So the story actually caught the attention of some major players in the publishing world, and some of them called her a writer of exceptional literary merit.
Oh, that would be amazing to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. So after that, Nancy was offered a contract for her first novel, which was published by Story Press, a new publishing imprint of Story Magazine.
Damn.
She was she had just found like big success writing.
Yeah, seriously.
But unfortunately, it was short-lived. On the morning of April 10th, which was Good Friday, 1936, Lewis finished his breakfast around 8 in the morning and left to head into his office just a short time later. When he arrived, he found what he described as an amusing letter from a friend. So a little after 9 a.m., he called Nancy to tell her about the letter. This was the first of two calls that Nancy got that morning. The other call came from her friend, Georgia Mansbridge. She spoke with Georgia for a few minutes and then hung up around 10:15 a.m. She and Georgia made dinner plans for that night, and Georgia later told reporters, I feel sure no one was in her apartment when we spoke. Now, nobody heard anything from Nancy until about 11:30 in the morning, when Onita Smithhead, a maid in the apartment just below the Tittertons, actually heard somebody in the building yell, "Dudley, Dudley, Dudley." And then the voice suddenly went quiet. Dudley Mings was the building's handyman, so whoever this was presumably calling out for him. According to author Harold Schechter, there was an urgency to the cry, but since the tenants routinely shouted for Mings whenever a toilet overflowed, a ceiling light blew, or a sash window wouldn't open, the maid disregarded the cry, just thinking it was nothing more than that.
Yeah.
Which you can understand.
Yeah, of course.
So a short time later, a delivery boy from a local dry cleaner also arrived at Beekman Place. He had a dress for Nancy, and he was under the impression that she would be home. But after ringing the bell several times and getting no answer, he left. Just was going to deliver the dress at a different time.
Yeah.
At 4:15 p.m., another delivery arrived. This time it was an upholster, Theodore Kruger, and his assistant, John Fiorenza. They were there to deliver a love seat that Nancy had had reupholstered. And after climbing the four flights of stairs, they were surprised to find that the Titterton's front door was actually open slightly.
Oh, that must be so ominous.
Yeah. Kruger knocked on the door loudly and didn't get any response, but he assumed that maybe they left the door open for him so he could deliver the love seat. Like, they knew this delivery was coming. So the two men entered and they set the sofa down. Kruger left the bill on the seat and he intended to call later, but as they were making their way downstairs to leave, he realized that he didn't have their phone number, so he wasn't going to be able to call them and make good on this. So he went back up to the apartment to get the number before he and his assistant left. He later told the police, "I found the phone in the bedroom and took the number." And as he was turning to leave, Kruger noticed that the bathroom light was on and that the door was slightly open. So he went over and knocked, which pushed the door open just even wider. Mm. Standing in the doorway, he could see a woman's nude leg hanging over the side of the tub. He called out to her loudly, but there was no sign of movement. Now even more concerned, he inched closer to the tub and he looked inside. And he later said, "My knees began shaking and I felt sick. I shouted to Johnny, 'My God, something's happened to the missus. Call the police.'"
Ugh.
So Kruger's assistant did as he was told. And despite having not been in the bathroom at the time or having been told what his boss had discovered, he told the officer on the other end, "There's a woman tied up in the bathtub."
That's suspicious.
Uh-huh. That's weird.
Yeah.
So homicide detectives arrived at the apartment a few minutes later, and they confirmed what Fiorenza had claimed on the phone. Nancy was laying face down in the tub. She was nude except for a white slip around her waist and the pink pajama top and house coat that had been tied around her neck and used to strangle her.
That's awful.
There was really no sign of a struggle in the apartment, so detectives concluded that she had to have known her attacker and most likely let him in voluntarily.
That's even worse.
Based on the state of disarray in the bedroom, they assumed that some kind of assault had occurred there. The clothing that Nancy had been wearing that morning was strewn about the room, and it looked actually like it had been ripped from her body. So there was evidence of a struggle for sure. Examining the body, the medical examiner Thomas Gonzalez found ligature marks around her wrist and surmised that Nancy had been bound and most likely sexually assaulted before her pajamas were double knotted around her neck, and she was dumped in the bathtub.
Holy shit.
Just thinking of her pajamas being used to strangle her is so dark. But the most chilling information from the medical examiner was his determination that Nancy was still alive when her attacker put her body in the tub.
Oh, that's awful.
And she eventually died there from asphyxiation.
Oh.
Yeah.
For a gift that's always on time and lasts a lifetime, you can't do better than MasterClass. MasterClass is the only streaming platform where you can learn and grow with over 200 plus of the world's best. That's why Wirecutter calls it an invaluable gift. Gift unlimited learning. Learn from any MasterClass instructor anywhere on a smartphone, computer, smart TV, or even in audio mode. And the classes really do make a difference. 88% of members feel that MasterClass made a positive impact on their lives. I use this and you should too. I've been taking a class about the power of storytelling with LeVar Burton. I'm talking Reading Rainbow, ladies and gents. And also a creative writing class with Margaret Atwood. Yes, you heard that right. It has been such an amazing thing to hear from some of the best about what their process is, and to get inspired by honestly straight up icons. It really gets the creative juices flowing. I highly, highly recommend it. Masterclass always has great offers during the holidays, sometimes up to as much as 50% off. Head over to masterclass.com/morbid for the current offer. That's up to 50% off at masterclass.com/morbid. Masterclass.com/morbid.
Family and tradition are at the heart of the holidays. They're also at the heart of a delicious cup of Don Francisco's coffee. With 150 years of family roasting expertise passed down from generation to generation, you can say that coffee is in our DNA. And Don Francisco's coffee knows that no two coffee drinkers are alike. So whether you're an espresso drinker, a cold brew lover, or enjoy the classic comfort of a perfectly brewed cup of coffee, Don Francisco's has something for you. We offer a unique range of expertly roasted coffees and blends, along with a wide variety of indulgent flavors, using only the finest 100% Arabica beans from the world's best coffee-growing regions. Available in coffee pods, espresso capsules, cans and bags, ground and whole bean. Every cup is a delicious coffee experience that's sure to elevate any day. Don Francisco's Coffee, family-crafted coffee since 1870. Visit donfranciscos.com and use code WONDER to get 20% off your purchase until December 21st, 2024.
After doing his preliminary examination, Gonzalez ordered that Nancy's body be removed from the tub and transported to the morgue. And it was at that point that they discovered a 12-inch length of cord underneath her body, which presumably was what was used to bind her wrists. But remember, they were no longer bound. Yeah. Nancy's friend Georgia told reporters, "Poor little Nancy. She couldn't fight. She had no strength. She wouldn't know what to do. All she could do was scream." Because she was a woman of very small stature. She was very petite. Now, the crime scene didn't lend a lot of clues. The Venetian blinds were all shut, and the apartment had been dark when the two men arrived to deliver the love seat. In the bedroom, both beds appeared to still have been made from that morning, but the bed near the bathroom was, quote, slightly rumpled, as though somebody, perhaps during a struggle, had brushed heavily against it.
Hmm.
Investigators checked the fire escape and concluded that there was no way somebody would have been able to reach that from the street, so the killer definitely would have had to come through the front door.
Yeah.
And then in the bathroom, they did discover a fingerprint on the tub. And in the bedroom, they found a fountain pen on the floor. Just all the clues that they could have possibly found. While technicians continued to process the apartment, detectives fanned out around the building, just trying to talk to potential witnesses and any neighbors who may have heard something. The first person they talked to was obviously Nancy's husband, Lewis. He actually arrived at the apartment about an hour after police had started their investigation, and he hadn't been told about his wife's death yet. So he just walked into this.
Oh, that's awful.
And he was shocked to find countless detectives and police in his apartment when he got home.
Imagine showing up to that.
Yeah, he actually, when he heard what happened, he collapsed.
Oh, that breaks my heart.
Yeah, it's very sad. And given his horrified and very devastated response to what had happened, he really seemed like an unlikely suspect.
Yeah.
But they did confirm his alibi as well.
Yeah,
and
of course.
It checked out. So he had nothing to do with this.
Ugh.
The others who were initial but not very strong suspects included four painters who had been working in the building that day. And actually, theirs were among the fingerprints that had been discovered in the apartment. But since they were working in the apartment in the days leading up to this, that obviously made sense.
Yeah.
But they also had alibis that were checked into, and they were ruled out as suspects.
Okay.
Other than the maid in the apartment below, none of the neighbors actually heard any noises coming from the apartment that morning. And one neighbor told a reporter, "My collie is a very nervous dog. If there had been any great disturbance, I'm sure he would have barked."
Oh, so there you go.
Yeah.
And I believe that.
Yeah. There was, however, another strange occurrence relayed by Countess Alice Hoyos, who lived in the apartment two floors beneath the Titter
House. Countess.
The Countess.
Oh, shit.
And because she's a Countess, I just refer to her as the Countess.
The Countess.
According to the Countess. And this is really freaky. An unknown man had rung the bell at her apartment multiple times in the days before the murder.
Mm.
And she said each time it was like he was trying to disguise his voice so he sounded like somebody different each time he did this.
Oh.
And she told detectives each incident went the same way. She said the buzzer would ring, she would answer it, and then the man would say, "I'm looking for Miss," and then he would mumble a name.
What?
But
I don't like that.
Not actually come out and say any name.
Hoping somebody would open the door to be like, "Who are you looking for?"
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So obviously these freaked her out. These calls freaked her out because she was sure, like you just said, they were a ruse to get her to open the door. So she actually tried to get a good look at the man before he walked away. She told detectives he was young, wore good clothing, and seemed to be attempting to hide his face.
Hmm.
And she told them that the last time the man rang the bell was actually just a few hours before Nancy was murdered.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's haunting.
It is. So the following day, the medical examiner, Dr. Gonzalez, released his autopsy report, which confirmed, among other things, unfortunately, that Nancy had been sexually assaulted. And the cause of death was listed as ligature strangulation. Yeah. The report also stated that, quote, the strangulation caused a hemorrhage of the larynx and three slight internal hemorrhages of the scalp.
Wow.
So this was a violent assault.
Yeah.
So the time of death was listed between 11 and 11:30 a.m., and that was based on the fact that rigor mortis had, quote, become virtually complete by the time that Gonzalez made his preliminary examination around 5:30 p.m.
Okay.
And this more or less corresponded with what the downstairs maid said. She told police that she heard those screams coming from the apartment. And scratching and bruising on Nancy's hands and arms suggested that she actually had tried very hard to fight off her attacker. Ugh. In their statement to the press, a spokesperson for the NYPD appeared optimistic. He told reporters, there are a lot of things that haven't been developed yet. The research detectives have taken something to the laboratories for further examination. We're making a thorough search, but we won't be able to get any real basis for investigation until final reports from them. Now, despite the optimistic tone, the truth was that they really didn't have a lot of evidence to work with, and they had almost zero leads. Other than the short length of cord found with the body, which was pretty unremarkable, the only other significant clue was that unidentified fingerprint in the bathroom. Now, at that time, police forensic departments were actually just starting to work with a new fingerprinting process. They would use silver nitrate to lift prints from surfaces like fabric and porous materials.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, right? But the system was new and it was going to take a lot of time, so investigators had to be patient with that.
Mm-hmm.
So while investigators waited on science to provide any leads, the press seized upon the story of yet another murder in Beekman Place. Author Harold Schechter wrote that the killing occurred 1 week to the day after Vera Stretz's acquittal, only added to its lurid appeal.
Of course.
Now, she was somebody who lived in the apartment, Vera Stretz, and she had been accused of murdering her lover in a jealous rage, mm-hmm. but she was actually acquitted after she testified for hours on the stand that her murder had been committed in self-defense. The Daily Mirror was among the press who reported the story in a very crude manner. They quote, and this is awful, they quote, presented the gruesome sex killing as a five-panel comic strip, complete with graphic drawings of the corpse and a fedora-wearing detective bearing a marked resemblance to Dick Tracy.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Like,
they made a graphic novel out of the crime scene?
They made a literal comic strip, a five-panel comic strip. Like, you gotta be tapped.
Damn.
You gotta be tapped to
do
that.
That's, wow.
And
wow.
Just to publish that and be like, yeah, this is a good choice.
The amount of people that went through to approve that is astronomical.
With zero integrity.
And nobody was like, this isn't bad taste.
Yeah. I don't know how that got through. Other papers, particularly the tabloids, focused on Nancy's, quote, owlishly solemn, bookish demeanor, and claimed that she, quote, liked to parade around her apartment in a negligee, even when delivery boys and workmen were present.
Oh, shut the fuck up.
Number one, even if she did, that's her fucking prerogative. She's in her own home. And number two, oh, were you there? Did you know that?
Exactly.
Like, fuck off.
Ew.
And actually, that's incorrect. She was wearing pajamas, which she was strangled with. So
that's awful.
Nice try.
She knew whatever the fuck she wants.
It's her fucking apartment. But the more reputable outlets, like the New York Times, focused on the scientific aspects of the investigation, drawing comparisons to other recent cases where science actually played a critical role in catching the killers, like Richard Hauptmann, who was found responsible for the Lindbergh baby kidnapping and murder. A New York Times reporter wrote, test tubes bubbled, microscope experts bent over slides, and a group of police researchmen pondered possibly important notes yesterday. Fields of science almost ignored heretofore were entered yesterday, and some of the methods of scientific investigation suggested in the Hauptmann case have been resorted to. I just love how they used to talk about
I was them. Just going to say, I love the heretofore of it all.
Heretofore.
Yeah.
That's a fun, heretofore. That's got a nice mouthfeel.
It does.
Heretofore.
Heretofore.
Now, within days, the tabloids had resorted to sensational tactics like hiring psychic mediums to comment on the identity of the killer. In a Daily Mirror article a few days after the murder, the paper, quote, Miss Myra Kingsley, prominent astrologist, is claiming, quote, that the crime was due to the conjunction of the planet Mars, the war god, with the sun in the eighth house, which signifies death.
Okay.
She also consulted Nancy's chart and deduced, quote, the murderer was an older man and that he either came from or has gone to a distance since the crime was committed.
Okay.
Which it's like, there's a time and a place for astrology, and I just don't feel like it's here.
I don't think it's here.
And I don't know what somebody's chart can tell you about the person that murdered them.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Like, I know your chart can tell you a lot about you.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe when you're going to die, but it just feels inappropriate.
Yeah, this just, especially with how everybody else is treating it, like, let's not.
Yeah, and it's like, it'd be one thing if, like, you know, for some reason her husband wanted to consult with an astrologist about this, but it's a tabloid.
To just take it upon yourself is really wild.
Yeah, but she wasn't the only one. The Mirror were not alone in their tacky, sensational journalism. The New York Post, not wanting to be outdone, consulted their own astrologer, Belle Bart, and she claimed the murderer is German or English, has a light complexion, takes drugs or drinks, met Miss Titterton in the fall of 1935, and escaped from Beekman Place in a southwesterly direction. Again.
Okay.
I don't know how astrology would tell you that.
Yeah. Like, I'm not sure about that.
Astrology is not going to tell you how and where this man escaped to. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
No.
Meanwhile, actual detectives focused on the few pieces of evidence that they did have in the case, and the biggest piece among them was the length of cord found in the bathtub. Unlike a traditional rope that you would expect to find in a case like this, this cord was thin, and it looked like the kind of cord found on the blinds in the Titterton apartment.
Oh.
But all of the cords in the apartment blinds appeared to be intact, so it wasn't from them.
Hmm.
But given the length, a little over 12 inches, it seemed unrealistic that it would have bound Nancy's hands for very long. So detectives theorized that it had to have come from a longer piece of rope.
Okay.
And if that was the case, they believed, quote, the killer, intent on removing all physical evidence, had sliced off the rope and carried it away with him. However, in his rush to get away, he must have missed the shorter piece concealed under Nancy's body.
Oh.
And they were correct.
Okay.
Now, Nancy's funeral service was held on April 13th and attended by over 200 people.
Wow.
And
that's telling.
That's very telling. That same day, investigators released another statement to the press, this time to address the growing number of rumors in the press that Nancy had been having an affair and was murdered by her lover.
Oh my God.
Which was just completely untrue.
Seriously.
Assistant Chief Inspector John Lyons said, we are satisfied now that Mrs. Titterton voluntarily admitted the man. This does not mean, however, that he was a lover or a close friend. It may have been a salesperson or a repairman of some sort, someone who made a casual call.
Yeah, like, that's the thing. It doesn't need to be salacious.
Just because she let somebody in, it doesn't mean they were involved with each other romantically.
Exactly.
Investigators felt confident that they were zeroing in on the type of man who had murdered Nancy, but days after her body was discovered, they were still no closer to identifying a suspect. Ugh. The fingerprints that they pulled from the fabrics on the ligature were too degraded to be of use, and the skin fragments found under Nancy's nails were equally useless, unfortunately. By midweek, the list of potential suspects had narrowed even further, as Nancy's friends and family were all cleared one after the other. By the end of the week, investigators had run down pretty much all of their leads and finally admitted publicly that, despite the full-time efforts of 65 detectives on the case, they were at a loss.
Wow.
Yeah.
That would be devastating to hear.
Yeah, especially as her family, her husband, like, I can't imagine. All attempts to trace the manufacturing of the cord used to bind Nancy's hands had proved fruitless, but still the cord remained one of the only viable clues in the case. And finally, on April 17th, detectives got a break in the case when a representative from the Hanover Cordage Company in York, Pennsylvania, contacted them to confirm that that cord was one of many created in their own factory.
Wow.
Which is like, that's crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy.
According to the representative from the company, the cord contained Istley, which is a fiber nearly unique to their product, which led them to believe that it was one of theirs. And
Damn.
They also mentioned that it was commonly used in furniture upholstery.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
They gave detectives a complete list of their distributors, and investigators started tracking the various shipments from the distributors to see if any cordage had made its way to service people in or around Manhattan.
Mm.
After combing through a very large number of records, detectives finally traced a shipment to a New York City distributor who had among their clients Theodore Kruger, an upholsterer on the Upper East Side, and the man who had discovered Nancy's body, remember? Because remember, she was getting a delivery from an upholsterer on the morning of her murder. Detectives had actually interviewed Kruger extensively, and he had been ruled out as a suspect. They were able to confirm that he had been in the shop on the morning of the murder. His assistant, John Fiorenza, on the other hand, had not been ruled out. And as they started looking into Fiorenza's background, they learned that not only did he have a lengthy criminal history, but also a significant psychiatric report that described him as, among other things, a, quote, personality deviant who would have difficulty in learning to refrain from illegal acts from time to time.
Oh.
I also love
that's
that
scary.
It's from time to time.
Yeah, just every now and then.
Or sometimes he's going to have a hard time referring from illegal activities.
That, he's good.
Yeah.
Audible's best of 2024 picks are here. Discover the year's top audiobooks, podcasts, and originals in all your favorite genres. From memoirs and sci-fi to mysteries and thrillers, Audible's curated list in every category is the best way to hear 2024's best in audio entertainment. Like a stunning new full cast production of George Orwell's 1984. Heartfelt memoirs like Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's Lovely One. The year's best fiction, like The Women by Kristen Hanna, and Percival Everett's brilliantly subversive James. Audible. There's more to imagine when you listen. Go to audible.com/imagine and discover all the year's best waiting for you.
Why get all your holiday decorations delivered through Instacart? Because maybe you only bought two wreaths but have 12 windows. Or maybe your toddler got very eager with the advent calendar. Or maybe the inflatable snowman didn't make it through the snowstorm. Or maybe the twinkle lights aren't twinkling. Whatever the reason, this season, Instacart's here for hosts and their whole holiday haul. Get decorations from the Home Depot, CVS, and more through Instacart and enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
The more detectives learned about John Fiorenza, the more convinced they became that he was the most likely killer amongst their suspects. He was described as a, quote, grade school dropout with a dull, normal IQ and a face fixed in a perpetual smirk.
I love the dull, normal IQ. They're like
dull and normal.
Like so boring. Way to have a normal IQ.
Boring.
So fucking dull.
I love
that.
Describing something as dull just hits.
It does hit.
You're so dull.
That word just has like a
It really does.
Yeah.
But it seemed that he just really didn't have a lot going for him.
No, there's really nothing that sets him apart.
Yeah, never really had. At the time of the murder, he was a 24-year-old apprentice living with his mother and her second husband in Brooklyn. And he was, quote, withdrawn to the point of extreme social isolation, which is scary.
Yeah.
His stepfather told a reporter, and this was crazy, that, quote, Johnny had only spoken to him no more than 7 times in the past 11 years.
What?
His stepdad, whomst he lived with, had spoken to him no more than 7 times in 11 years.
Holy shit.
Like, what?
When you said extreme,
extreme,
you meant extreme.
Yeah,
that's like agoraphobia, isn't it? Something akin to that.
Maybe
is there something, you know, adjacent to that? I would say.
Probably. Like he left the house, but it was like a social agoraphobia. It was just like, I guess.
Like extreme.
Yeah.
Whoa. Like that's just like I'm a quiet person.
Yeah, you would consider yourself an introvert.
Yeah, I consider myself an introvert, and that is mind-boggling to me.
Well, because you're living in the same home as somebody. Like, you don't even... And you're living in New York, so presumably you're living in an apartment.
Yeah.
And you don't just, like, exchange pleasantries in the morning.
That's the thing. I'm like, what's going on there?
I'm also like, what did you say in those 7 times?
Damn.
Yeah. He also... it was said that he hadn't started dating until a few years earlier. And he's 24, so of course that's a bit unusual. But he had started seeing his girlfriend, Pauline D'Antonio, and he was planning to marry her in the fall, actually.
Oh.
They were engaged.
Okay.
Yeah, but his criminal history went back more than a decade, and his first arrest happened when he was 12 years old.
I mean, that's not great.
That's not great.
It's not a good start.
No, he had stolen a bicycle, and since then he had just been in and out of trouble with the law on a regular basis.
Jeez.
For the most part, the crimes that he committed were petty. They were like thefts, but there was a grand larceny charge for stealing musical instruments from a store.
Okay.
And during one of his periods of incarceration, he was examined by a prison psychiatrist who described him as a, quote, neurotic type of personality deviant. With him, the wish is father to the thought and leads quickly to action without consideration or foresight.
Interesting.
Yeah, more simply put, he was the type of person who acted very impulsively and based on what he wanted in the moment without any kind of consideration for consequences.
I see.
And this, the psychiatrist believed, was supported by his many brazen crimes, including stealing cars in the middle of the day in full view of crowds of people, but just because he wanted to take them for a joyride.
Damn.
But would literally just like break into a car and take it.
It's like, whatever.
And just didn't give a shit.
It's mine.
Yeah. Now, despite John's criminal history and dull personality.
So dull.
Theodore Krueger had taken pity on John and hired him, like we said, as an upholstery assistant 3 years earlier. Upholstery was a skill that John had actually learned during one of his prison stays. For the most part, his job was just to sweep up the studio, keep the front windows clean, help out with deliveries. But occasionally, Krueger had him assist with more complicated tasks. As far as Krueger was concerned, John was, quote, good-natured, but not very quick-witted. And his criminal record, which Krueger described as being over little things, had kept John from finding success.
Okay.
Krueger thought that John seemed determined to better his life, though, and he found that to be an admirable quality, so he took a chance on him.
Which I get that.
Yeah, and Krueger seems like a nice guy.
Yeah, it seems like an admirable quality.
Yeah, if somebody is showing you.
Seems like they really are.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, the morning that they were to deliver the love seat to Nancy Titterton's apartment, John had arrived a few hours late to work, telling his boss that he had been at an appointment with his probation officer. So that's interesting.
Yeah. I was going to say probation officer. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but you know, still he's checking in with his probation officer. You know, so Kruger's like, he's doing the right thing. He's being a good kid.
Like he's doing what he needs to do.
Yeah. He's trying to better himself.
Yeah.
Now, although they had traced the cord back to Krueger's shop and they were pretty confident that they had found their killer at this point, investigators knew that the cord alone was not going to be able to hold him for very long, and especially not on a murder charge. After all, that particular cord had been shipped to many upholstery shops, and they couldn't be sure if it definitely came from Theodore Krueger's shop.
So this was all, like, very tenuous.
Yeah, very tenuous. So rather than arrest him, John was placed under 24-hour surveillance while detectives and forensic experts desperately searched for any additional evidence that would lead to a conviction. Now, after 1 week of investigation, the Titterton apartment had been thoroughly searched, and it really seemed unlikely that any new evidence was going to be discovered. But just in case, on April 20th, Dr. Alexander Gettler, a biochemist who was working with the NYPD, went back to the Beekman Place apartments in hope of finding anything new.
Mm.
Now, he had been the one actually to discover the isley contained within the cord and eventually traced its origin. So without him, like, this all...
You'd be nowhere near this.
It never would have happened. And if anybody was going to find something that somebody had missed, it was going to be this guy. At the apartment, he was combing over Nancy's bedspread with a high-powered magnifying glass, when he discovered one single hair that the other technicians had missed.
Stop.
A single hair.
This guy for life.
No, honestly. It makes me think of Spencer Reed. It makes me think of Spencer from Criminal Minds.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? I just picture him like going over it with like a high-powered glass.
Yes.
Now later, he described the hair as white and, quote, strangely stiff. He said it certainly was not human. Now, after examining the hair under a microscope, he determined that it was horse hair, which was the kind typically used by upholsterers.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Yep. Now, aware that the Tittersons had, had their love seat delivered on the morning of the murder, Gettler took a sample of the horse hair from the love seat and compared it to the one that he discovered on the bed, and the two were a match.
Ah.
So that hair that was found on Nancy's bed was a match to the love seat that had been delivered that morning.
Shit.
Now, given that the hair came from the love seat, it didn't seem unreasonable that one of the hairs made its way to another location in the apartment, but that love seat hadn't been delivered until after Nancy was killed, which meant that the only way it could have gotten mixed up on the bedclothes or the bedspread was if the killer had it on him when he sexually assaulted Nancy on the bed.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And this was precisely the piece of evidence that detectives needed to break that case wide open.
Damn.
So they went back to Theodore Krueger, who was absolutely shocked to learn that his assistant was even a suspect. He told detectives that John Fiorenza was a, quote, perfect gentleman, and assured him, quote, there was never anything about him that was bad. He said, why, I've even seen him take the meat out of his sandwich for lunch and give it to our dog.
Oh.
Which is very sweet, but like,
okay,
murderers are nice to animals sometimes.
I was just going to say, okay, so we're trying to make a connection here that if you feed a dog, you meat couldn't have possibly murdered a human being.
No, never.
Got it.
Theodore seems very naive.
I was just going to say, but that just seems like, but that's such a nice thing to do. And give a dog your sandwich meat.
It is.
How could you be that nice?
But doesn't mean that you didn't murder somebody.
It's true.
I feel bad.
That's very, because you can tell it like he was not wanting to accept what was in front of him.
And I feel bad too because, that would make you doubt any kind of confidence you have in anybody.
Of course it would.
You're like, I took a chance on this guy. I really thought he was, you know, wanting to better himself. And I mean, had he not given him a chance, Nancy would still be alive, technically, possibly.
Well, and
so
it's
you
like,
just think constantly, like, what course. The fuck?
And that's the thing. Like, I can't imagine what it feels like to have interacted and found yourself, like, enjoying the company of a person who murders someone. Like, that must be hard to reconcile.
Absolutely.
But it has nothing to do with you.
No, absolutely not. In fact,
in case you're out there and that happened to you, like, you're probably don't think it has anything to do with you.
No, you're a better person than most of us.
You should be able to trust people who are showing you that they're bettering themselves.
Exactly. And like we said, he was putting out illusions that he was bettering himself. And Theodore confirmed to the detectives that it was true that John had been late to work on the morning of the murder, but he said it was only because he had his weekly appointment with his probation officer. He's like, he's doing the right thing. Now, Fiorenza's alibi, the probation appointment, was the last piece of the puzzle that detectives needed to knock down before they could arrest him. Fortunately, that proved a lot easier than they could have expected. Like I said, the Friday that Nancy was murdered was Good Friday, and John's probation officer, a very strict Catholic, had taken that day off. So there was no way John met with his probation officer.
Wow.
Exactly.
What?
So then why was he late?
Wow.
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 All the way this case came together, like I said at the beginning, like that's why these old-timey cases are so intriguing to us, because it's not, oh, his DNA was found at the crime scene.
Or they saw him on a camera.
Yeah, they saw him on a camera. This is like old-fashioned detective
work. This is like, you have to go talk to this person, you find out from this person that this person wasn't working that day, so this person's story doesn't line up.
Right.
Like the fact that it lined up that way, that it was Good Friday. And so, like, it happened to be the day that he, a strict Catholic, took off.
Yeah.
That's, like, crazy.
That's crazy. And, like, the investigator who went back and found the hair that nobody else had found, and it was this one, picture one strand of horse hair.
Yeah.
Like, that's, like, a small hair. It's like finding a dog hair on your bed.
Yeah.
But just finding that back then, and then going back and saying, oh, that's from the furniture that was reupholstered, like,
it's unbelievable.
It really is. So with the newly discovered evidence in hand and John's alibi disproven, detectives moved quickly to arrest their suspect. And at first, John denied having anything to do with the murder. He insisted he was innocent. But after more than 16 hours of relentless interrogation, he asked to speak to Commissioner Louis Valentine. And he told the commissioner, give me a cigarette and I'll tell you all I know.
Damn.
All for just a cigarette.
Wow.
According to his confession, John had gone to the Tittertons' apartment on April 9th, the day before the murder, to pick up the love seat with Theodore Krueger. And as soon as he saw Nancy, he said, the idea came to me of doing what I did to her afterward.
Oh my God.
Yeah. As far as he could tell, Nancy was a slight woman, just about 100 pounds. He said she seemed gentle and soft-spoken, so he was pretty sure she wouldn't put up much of a fight, which he was wrong about, because she did.
Fuck that guy.
And the next morning, he called Krueger to say he'd be late, and then he grabbed the 52-inch length of cord he'd taken from the upholstery studio the day before and made his way to the Titterton apartment. When he arrived there, he rang the bell, and Nancy released the door to let him in because she knew who he was.
Yeah.
Upstairs, he told her he'd come about the love seat, and he wanted to know where she wanted it. He said, just to get her in there, I asked her, didn't she want the love seat in the bedroom? And the question prompted her to go to the bedroom to see if maybe she'd like the furniture in there, and Fiorenza followed her. Once they were in the bedroom, trigger warning, this is pretty graphic. He attacked Nancy and grabbed, quote, whatever it was she had in her hand and stuffed it in her mouth so she couldn't yell anymore.
Oh my God.
Which is why nobody heard anything.
Yeah.
With Nancy gagged, he started ripping off her clothes in a frenzy, and then he sexually assaulted her. He said, from time to time, when she started to scream as the gag worked loose, I throttled her with my hands.
Oh my God.
And just says this, like, he's recounting a TV show that he watched.
What a fucking animal.
Yeah, truly. When he was done, he grabbed the pajamas and the dressing coat from the floor, knotted them together, and used that clothing to strangle Nancy. Which is like, how do you go from like grand larceny, stealing cars, to raping and murdering a woman this brutally?
It's inconceivable. It's but when really you look scary. At this guy, he looks like such a little piece of shit.
He sure does.
Like
he
he's got dull. It right on his face. He does look dull.
He's got a dull, stupid, perpetual smirk. And that's the perfect way to describe it. It's not a smile. It's a smirk.
It's a little shit-eating smirk. That's what it is. Grin, yeah.
At first, he said he thought about filling the tub to make it look like Nancy died by accident, which I'm like, that wouldn't have worked because you strangled her and assaulted her, but okay.
But cool.
But he couldn't find the plug, so he left her face down to strangle.
Oh, God.
Before he left, he got a knife from the kitchen and cut the cord that he used to bind her hands, assuming that he had taken it all with him when he left.
But he's dull.
Mm-hmm. So he didn't. He managed to get out of the apartment, he said, without being seen, tossed the cord in a public trash can, and then stepped into a drugstore to call his boss and say he'd be a little later than he thought because he was, you know, meeting with his probation officer, doing the right thing, cleaning up his act.
He's such a good guy.
Such a good guy. Gives meat to dogs.
Fuck that guy.
When he finally got back to the shop a little before noon, the two men finished fixing Nancy's love seat. So he's sitting there fixing her love seat,
knowing what full he's well done.
That she's dead in a bathtub.
Holy shit.
And then they loaded it onto the truck and headed for Beekman Place.
Wow.
When they asked why he had done what he did, he seemed just as confused and said, she wasn't my type. If I saw her on the street, I wouldn't give her a second look.
Fuck you.
Just to be a dick.
Literally
one more
fuck
time.
You.
I don't know. I wouldn't have given her a second glance, but I guess I just felt like it that day.
Oh, excuse me.
Go fuck yourself.
Cool. Yeah.
The arrest did come as a shock to those who knew him personally. His girlfriend, Pauline, refused to believe that he'd committed the murder or was even capable of such a crime, which you got to believe when he confesses that he did it. But also,
yeah,
I can understand not thinking that somebody you love is capable of that.
No, of course.
And she told a group of reporters assembled outside her apartment, he did not do it. They're telling lies about him. He did not confess. He would not have confessed to such a thing. He will be back and we will be married in September.
Babe, here's the thing. If that is the case, like if he has been implicated in this, something's awry.
Something is awry for sure.
So maybe don't be so sure that you're going to get married in September. Because
yeah,
it's like,
so sure.
I don't know if he's a great guy.
Probably not.
You know?
If he's implicated in this, most likely not. Obviously, yeah. We see cases where false confessions happen and yada, yada,
this
yada.
This is not one of those.
This exactly is not one of those.
And I'm just like, he has a shit-eating grin. You got to be careful of those ones.
Yeah. Honestly, good for her that she was able to get away eventually.
Honestly.
Now, and this is sad, obviously. John's mother was similarly stunned. She told reporters, Johnny was a good boy. He had a girl. They were going to be married.
Like, ugh.
Murderers like, do sometimes get married. Theodore Kruger echoed the disbelief, telling reporters, he was a nice boy, I always thought. Why, I remember when he saw the body, he said to me, this must be the work of a maniac.
That and that's the other thing. It's like, we can look at it from this side and be like, no, like he did it, come on.
But these people were like, spending every day with him.
Exactly. These people were actually getting to know him and had, again, there's so many people in my life that if something like this happened, I'd be like,
no,
what?
No
like,
way.
You know what I mean? Like, I can't think of one person that I'd be like, oh, yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Like, you and probably like, shouldn't have someone in your life if you think that.
His mom, his girlfriend, and somebody he worked every single day with. And I can't imagine working with somebody, discovering a body with someone, and having that experience.
And then finding out they did it.
Finding out that they did it and reacted in the moment, like, so normally, like,
yeah,
you would expect,
like organically,
yeah, like, oh, yeah. This must be the work of a maniac. Meanwhile, he's the maniac.
No, that would be really,
yeah,
like, that would fuck you up.
That would fuck you up for a long
for
time,
sure.
Definitely. Could you tell me exactly how much money you spent on food last month? How about entertainment or travel? Probably not, but Rocket Money can. Rocket Money categorizes all of your expenses and helps you set a budget for different categories like bills, utilities, dining, drinks, travel, vacation, entertainment, and so many more. With Rocket Money, you know exactly where your money is going. Rocket Money is like a personal finance app that empowers you to save more, spend less, and take control of your financial life. They'll calculate your monthly spending allowance and alert you when you're too close to going over budget so that you can save more and spend less. It's been that specific tool has been really helpful for me because sometimes it's like, hey, girly, red alert, calm down with that credit card. And I'm like, okay, I got it, dad. Thanks. I mean, Rocket Money. Rocket Money has over 5 million happy members and has saved its users over $1 billion across all of the app's features. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Get Rocket Money today at rocketmoney.com/morbid. That's rocketmoney.com/morbid. rocketmoney.com/morbid. Now, despite their disbelief, John was arraigned the following day on charges of rape and first-degree murder, which, again, he confessed to the crime. After the arraignment, he accompanied detectives back to the Titterton apartment, where he reenacted the crime and also retraced his escape route. With a full confession and now very strong evidence, the assistant prosecutor predicted a very speedy trial and announced he would take the case to the grand jury and to a grand jury in the coming days. The judge at the arraignment, magistrate, I think it's Aurelio, commended the police and the prosecutor's office for their efficiency and skill. He said, "This case proves that no crime can be hidden from effective police work. As a citizen of this city, I feel extremely proud of the work done by the police."
Honestly, they deserve that praise because this was really good police work.
Incredible.
Yeah.
In his statement to the press, Commissioner Valentine, quote, did not conceal his satisfaction of the unraveling of a mystery. The press and even several of his own detectives had deemed unsolvable.
Yeah.
And look where they were now. He noted that not only was this the biggest murder investigation in New York history to that point, but he also emphasized the fact that it wouldn't have been solved without the dedication of more than 65 police officers.
Mm-hmm.
And, quote, the help of their technical research lab in Brooklyn and of the city toxicology laboratory. While detectives on the case were relentless in the pursuit of Nancy's killer, quote, science, Valentine told reporters, quote, played a deciding role in the solution.
Yeah.
Which I knew you would love.
I love that. It was science.
Science.
It was.
With the killer caught, the DA, William Dodge, assured residents and reporters that he had every intention of moving quickly to secure his indictment and conviction. Just 3 days after the arrest, Fiorenza's case went to a grand jury on April 25th. And after reviewing the evidence and listening to the testimony from 8 witnesses, an indictment for first-degree murder was returned in less than half an hour.
Whoa.
Despite the hearing, Fiorenza's attorneys, quote, brought strong intimations that they would seek to have him declared insane and would assail the method with which his confession was obtained.
Please.
Yeah, ridiculous. They insisted, despite the fact that he confessed multiple times to rape and murder, that he actually had nothing to do with the crime and had actually been coerced into a confession.
I doubt it.
Yeah, me too. True to their word, though, the district attorney's office moved very quickly, surprisingly quick. And John's trial started May 20th, just a little over a month after the murder occurred. Anticipating that Fiorenza's team would go for an insanity plea, Dodge's office enlisted at least 4 highly regarded psychiatrists to argue otherwise. But to their surprise, Fiorenza's lawyer, Henry Klauber, made a different claim and again asserted that his client had nothing to do with the murder. He told the jury a fiend was on the loose and it was not this defendant who murdered Mrs. Titterton, as he pointed over to his client. According to the defense, another woman had been attacked in the area days before Nancy, and they intended to show that it was the same attacker and not John Fiorenza who was responsible for the murder.
It's a good tactic.
It's like, that's cool. Why did he confess multiple times then? Klauber's claim certainly wouldn't have been the first time a defense lawyer had attempted to pin the blame on just a mysterious unnamed person.
Of course.
But the problem was that he had no evidence to support his claim.
Oof.
And once the jury heard Fiorenza's full and very convincing confession read aloud in court, he changed strategies and started building that insanity defense.
I love that he was like, I knew I was missing something. evidence. It was evidence. Yeah.
My bad. And just to be safe, his cross-examination of the detectives who took the confession indicated that he was ready to challenge it on the grounds of coercion.
So I think that's all he's got.
He's playing a dirty game.
That's all he's got.
Exactly. Much to the surprise of the prosecution, though, while their previous defense didn't appear to be working out, Clauber and the rest of the defense team just seem to be keeping all their options open and juggling several arguments at once.
Yeah, you gotta hedge your bets there.
Not a great plan, though, yeah. to go for everything all at the same
Probably
time.
Probably not, but yeah. When you got nothing, you gotta work with everything.
You know, exactly. The insanity plea seemed the best bet, but they still called John's mother to the stand.
Oop.
Who testified that contrary to the confession, her son hadn't left the house until a little before 11 a.m. on the morning of the murder, which would have made it impossible for him to have committed the murder and still made it to work by 12:30 p.m.
Hmm.
Which it's like, yeah, timelines are a little rough, and I don't think we should rely on his mom's version of events, unfortunately.
If anyone's going to lie for you, it's going to be your mom.
It's your mom. In support of their insanity defense, Clauber also called John's stepfather, Ignazi Kupany, to testify to John's unusual behavior going back many years.
Like he didn't speak to him for 11 years, basically.
Yes, exactly. In addition to hardly ever speaking at home. His stepfather told the court, he, quote, used to sit down all the time in the rocking chair with his head between his hands. When this happened, he would look up and he would say, "Who's calling?" And we would say, "No one's calling. We hear nothing."
That's strange.
It is. And his stepfather also got down from the stand and demonstrated some of John's other unusual behaviors. He said he also had a tendency to, quote, catch something or someone invisible who was following or calling him.
That's weird.
It's weird.
And it's very, like, specific.
It is very specific, you know? And I believe maybe it happened. Like,
interesting.
I don't know. Other family members, including John's aunt, gave additional testimony in support of what his stepfather had told the court. But a lot of this testimony was undermined during cross-examination by the DA, William Dodge, who clearly established that no matter how strange John's behavior might have been, it couldn't have been too severe because he managed to hold down a full-time job and a romantic relationship for several years.
That's exactly what I was thinking is like, yeah, that was very specific what he was saying. So like there could absolutely be truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just being weird.
That's the thing.
Like it's not... I'm not like, wow, he's insane. It's like, no, he seems just strange.
Yeah.
He seems a little weird.
Exactly.
But not weird enough that he's not fully functioning in society. And it's like, if you're fully functioning, holding down a job, having a romantic relationship, then you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're aware of the consequences of your actions.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Exactly. So finally, Clauber called on Dr. Albert Crane, and this is where it all went wrong.
Uh-oh.
Albert Crane was a psychiatrist from Staten Island who had examined John. According to Crane, John was a, quote, dementia precox case with a split mentality incapable of realizing the nature and quality of his acts. Of course, the question of his sanity wasn't the issue so much as whether he knew what he was doing was wrong at the time, and that was something Crane couldn't deny.
Okay.
On cross-examination, Dodge asked the psychiatrist, quote, if he made a confession to the police and was then asked by an assistant district attorney to state the facts again, and he refused on the grounds that it would be used against him, would you say that he knew or did not know the nature or quality of his acts?
Boom! So what a good, like, just can you answer that quick question, please?
Yeah, could you just let me know? Could you remind me if that, if that works out with your
insanity
defense?
That was some top-notch lawyering.
Now, Crane, who's literally sitting on the stand and knew that this is exactly what had happened in the case, and had also sworn to tell the truth, had no choice but to undermine his own previous testimony.
Oh.
He replied, I would say that he was keenly aware of the nature and quality of his behavior at that
time. Oh, no.
So
I could not stop there. I'd be like, so why did you say he was?
So
like,
why?
Wait a second.
So why'd you say that?
Explain to me.
Imagine as a psychiatrist sitting on that stand and trying, you're a witness for the defense.
Eek.
And then the DA gets you that easily.
Well, and it's like, you just said some bullshit. Like, you just laid down some bullshit.
And then
shit.
Had to sit up there and undermine your own shit.
Yeah, they just untie that bullshit with one finger.
Yeah.
Bloop.
Also, it's giving Elle Woods.
It is. That's a like mic drop moment.
Truly. Now, the insanity claim was even further weakened when Dodge called on four of his own psychiatric expert witnesses, all of whom testified that whether or not he experienced symptoms of mental illness, John Fiorenza knew that rape and murder were wrong, yeah. and that is why he went to great lengths to cover up his crimes.
Exactly.
Clearly. Both sides rested their cases on May 27th, and at 3:30 p.m., the jury retired for deliberation. However, after 11 hours, the jury remained deadlocked, primarily over whether or not Fiorenza was insane when he committed the crime.
Guys, he wasn't.
If he was, they would have had the option of sending him to a state hospital for the rest of his life. No. But if he was deemed sane and found guilty, he would most likely receive the death penalty. Which I can understand why they were having a hard time with that, yeah. like having that decision on your own heart and
yeah,
head
that
is
goes
heavy.
On your conscience.
Right. But finally, after nearly 20 hours of deliberation, they did side with the prosecution and they found John Fiorenza guilty of the murder and rape of Nancy Titterton.
I agree with that.
He seemed pretty unfazed by the verdict, but those close to him were outraged. His father stood up and shouted, "It's not fair. He's crazy. He should not go to the chair. They should lock him up."
Which
you can understand.
Yeah, and honestly, I agree.
Yeah.
In that sense.
Yeah.
Where it's like, yeah, that's hard. It's like, because I,
that's
again,
his family. They know him
better
than
anybody. Should be going to the death penalty because I don't really think it's, you know, we've already discussed how we feel about that. But
yeah.
it's like, so I feel like he's got to be locked up.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
But on June 6, 1936, John Fiorenza appeared before the Court of General Sessions for sentencing. And he was formally sentenced to die in the electric chair.
Damn.
At the hearing, his attorney continued to push his insanity defense, telling reporters, "He doesn't even know what all this is about. He was more anxious to know when I can visit him in the death house," which is sad in some sense, you know?
Yeah.
Under New York law, though, a guilty verdict in a death penalty case automatically triggers an appeal.
Mm.
But like in the initial trial, the appeals process moved quickly. Not surprisingly, John's attorney insisted that although his client had killed Nancy, he had only done so because of what his psychiatrist referred to as a mental confusion.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I don't see this.
I think he's possibly mentally ill, but I think he knew what he was doing was wrong.
He tried to cover it up.
He went to her house the day before, decided that he wanted to kill her,
yeah.
came back prepared to kill her, raped and killed her, and then disposed of evidence.
Exactly. And then later lied about it.
Yeah.
And made it at the scene. He said, "Oh, a maniac must have done that."
Right.
That shows you he knew exactly what he had done.
He continued to cover
That's
it
why
up.
I can't, like, well, I'm not like a fan of the death penalty. It's
Same.
Like, I don't think like the he's crazy, but no, I don't think he is.
I think
he's
should
just
spend
a weirdo.
The rest of his life in jail.
Yeah. I think he's in the negative connotation, a weirdo.
Yeah. He's disturbed.
And I think he needs to go to jail forever.
Yeah.
But that's it.
Mm hmm.
Like, I don't think he's insane. I don't think there's this whole confusion that they're claiming, I think, is highly exaggerated.
There was also multiple, if you rape somebody before you kill them, there's multiple times at which you can stop
exactly.
before you kill
and
them.
And he didn't.
And he didn't. So
he went further and further.
Exactly.
He even said when she tried to scream, he would throttle her to stop her.
Which
that's showing
tells you
that he didn't want to be caught and he knew he was doing something bad and he did something awful to make sure it was covered up.
Exactly.
So fuck this guy.
Exactly. Thank you.
And now all of a sudden I'm like, fuck that.
You know, fuck him. It's the part where his family talks about.
Yeah, you feel bad.
You feel bad for his family.
A family of a monster who, you know,
they're
seemingly has
too.
Nothing to do with what they've done. It's like, that's a whole different. I do feel bad for them.
Yeah, you have to. Like,
you know,
are victims too in this whole thing.
For sure.
Arguing in favor of upholding the death penalty, though, William Dodge insisted, "This man is a potential maniac. There is no reason for the state of New York to be cheated of the law, of the enforcement of the law by the pretense of insanity." Which I kind of agree with.
Mm-hmm.
Although, again, don't agree with the death penalty.
Yeah, but I think he is. He's a maniac is a great way to describe him.
Yeah, he's a danger to society. Exactly.
He's
literally. Yeah.
He called it.
In
he
his
said
own
a
words.
Maniac did that.
Yep.
He knows what he is. And it's like he should be kept away from society for sure.
I completely agree. Ultimately, his appeal was denied, and on January 22, 1937, he was executed in the electric chair at Sing Sing Prison. Just prior to his death, he exclaimed, "You don't know all I've been through in this place. I don't know why they don't give me a chance."
I know.
Because you raped and murdered somebody.
Pick me. I know.
Yeah, we all know.
You did something fucking terrible. Like, God.
And you can't get a chance.
Give
after
me a
you...
chance. Can you give Nancy a chance?
Nope, you can't.
No, you can't. Because you already raped her. And murdered her.
Exactly.
And then tried to cover it up and lie about it. So, yeah. Fuck you, John.
Such a wild case from start to finish, though. And
it is.
The key star here is the detective work, like,
yes,
for the it's early 1930s and they had all this advanced, not advanced, but at the time very advanced, yeah, fingerprint technology and just, mm-hmm, the dedication of people who went back to the scene.
Yeah.
I found the investigation part of this so interesting.
Oh, I think it's amazing. Like, yeah, what an amazing case, like, in when on the police side of it,
and what a
tragic case, senseless, on the crime side of it. Like, Nancy, you just feel like, holy shit.
Like, yeah, like, she was just getting her career off the ground. And she's just having a delivery.
She's just home. We all get deliveries.
All the time.
You let someone come into your home and plop down a piece of furniture and you hope they're not there for nefarious reasons. Like, yep, that's awful.
And that when her poor husband, too, like, oh, it's stumbling awful home to that.
Yeah, that's awful.
Very, very tragic case.
Yeah.
But very, very interesting on the investigation side, yeah, like for sure. But with all that being said, we hope you keep listening.
And we hope you
keep
it
weird. But not so weird that when you deliver something to somebody's house, you decide that you're going to rape and murder them. Because, ew, that's really fucking terrible. And you should stop yourself from doing things like that. Bye.
Don't be a dick.
Self-control is important. If you like Morbid, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
They say Hollywood is where dreams are made. A seductive city where many flock to get rich, be adored, and capture America's heart. But when the spotlight turns off, fame, fortune, and lives can disappear in an instant. When TV producer Roy Radin was found dead in a canyon near LA in 1983, there were many questions surrounding his death. The last person seen with him was Lainey Jacobs, a seductive cocaine dealer who desperately wanted to be part of the Hollywood elite. Together, they were trying to break into the movie industry, but things took a dark turn when $1 million worth of cocaine and cash went missing. From Wondery comes a new season of the hit show Hollywood and Crime, The Cotton Club Murder. Follow Hollywood and Crime, The Cotton Club Murder on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Cotton Club Murder early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.